Now, to the more important aspect of tonight's gathering. It is my pleasure and honor to introduce Dr. V.S. Ramachandran, author of The Telltale Brain, A Neuroscientist's Quest for What Makes Us Human. Hailed by Richard Dawkins as the Marco Polo of neuroscience, Dr. Ramachandran is based at UC San Diego, where he is director of the Center for Brain and Cognition, and he's also a distinguished professor in the psychology department and the neurosciences program. Dr. Ramachandran has published over 180 scientific papers, and his book, Phantoms in the Brain, has been translated into nine languages and was the basis for a PBS special in the U.S. In 2005, he received the Henry Dale Medal and was elected to Honorary Life Fellowship by the Royal Institution of Great Britain. In 2007, the President of India conferred upon him the title of Padma Bhushan, which is the third highest civilian award in India. Newsweek magazine named Dr. Ramachandran a member of the Century Club, one of the 100 most prominent people to watch in the next century. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Ramachandran.
Thank you. Well, I'm delighted and honored to be here, and thank you so much for that fine introduction. And as was pointed out, I direct a research center at the University of California concerned with structure and functions of the human brain. This is a field that's called behavioral neurology or cognitive neuroscience. Can people at the back hear me fine? Okay, this one, I don't know if this is working or not. It is working. Okay, all right. So just to pause for a second and consider the problem we're dealing with here, just to put things in perspective. Here is a human brain, schematic representation of the human brain. For some reason the pointer isn't working. Can we get the pointer to work? Okay. Can somebody get the pointer to work? Or here is a 3-pound mass of jelly you can hold in the palm of your hand. But this mass of jelly can contemplate the vastness of interstellar space, contemplate the meaning of infinity, the meaning of God, ask disquieting questions about its own place in the cosmos, indeed, even introspect on its own introspections, what you call self-awareness. The question is, how does all this come about from this lump of jelly you can hold in your palm? And to gain some idea of the complexity of the brain, you just have to look at numbers. Brain, it turns out, is made up of neurons, as you all know. These are the basic structural and functional units of the nervous system. I'll just use my hand. Structural and functional units of the nervous system. And each neuron can make something like 1,000 to 10,000 contacts with other adjacent neurons, points of contact. They're called synapses. Each synapse can be on or off, can be inhibitory, it can be excitatory. And based on this, someone has calculated the number of possible permutations and combinations of brain activity, number of possible brain states, exceeds the number of elementary particles in the universe. So this gives you some idea of the complexity of the organ you're dealing with. So how do you even begin to study it? Well, several approaches. One is to do brain imaging, ask somebody to wiggle his finger, see what part of the brain becomes active using functional magnetic resonance, or any cognitive task like reading and or seeing color or seeing movement, and see what parts of the brain light up. We sometimes use this technique. Another technique is to record from individual nerve cells in the brain, monitor the activity of nerve cells in the brain, and eavesdrop on that activity. So, for example, if you go to the visual pathways and record from individual nerve cells, if you ring a bell, the cell will not fire. If you touch the person, the cell will not fire. But if you show a bar of light, the cell will fire. It's the correct orientation and the correct location in space, a cell will fire. So you can call this a visual neuron. So this is called single unit neurophysiology. So there's brain imaging, which you can do on people, single unit neurophysiology generally done on animals, but you can also do it on people these days. And the third technique, well, there are several techniques, but I'm just going to mention three. The third technique, the one we use quite a bit, is called behavioral neurology. And that is look at patients who've sustained damage to a tiny part of the brain, have a lesion caused by a stroke or a tumor or head injury, affecting only a small part of the brain. What you then get is not an overall blunting of all the cognitive capacities, but often a highly selective loss of one specific function, with other functions being preserved. For example, you might just you lose the ability to perceive faces, but you can still read a book or see colors. So this gives you some confidence in asserting that that region of the brain is somehow involved or specialized for that particular function alone. And this whole field is known as cognitive neuroscience or behavioral neurology. And I'm going to give you a couple of striking examples of this. So what we've done is basically taken well-known neurological syndromes, or some of them are not well-known, and then bring them for that have been known for over 100 years or 50 years, but nobody has studied very carefully, brought them from the clinic to the laboratory and done some intensive research on these patients, try and figure out what's going on in the patient's brain that can explain the bizarre symptoms. But not just that, so that's often satisfying for the patient to know that he's not crazy, there's something gone wrong with the circuitry in his brain. It's even better if you can fix it, but the first step is to understand what's going on before you can fix it. The third agenda is what deeper implications does it have for understanding the structure and functions of the normal brain? That's the real agenda. Okay, so we've got three agendas, a clinical agenda, explaining the patient's symptoms, and also the broader implications for understanding normal brain function. So let me give you one or two examples of this. One example is a disorder called face blindness, or also known as face blindness or prosopagnosia, when there is damage. See, the brain has three, four lobes, frontal lobe there, parietal, occipital, and temporal. And so if there's damage to the medial, or the inner surface of the temporal lobe, the inner bottom surface of the temporal lobe of the brain, what you get is a syndrome called prosopagnosia. The patient can no longer recognize people's faces. There's a particular gyrus or brain structure about the size of my pinky, which when it's damaged there on both sides of the brain, you get a disorder called prosopagnosia, face blindness. This person can no longer recognize people by looking at their faces. In fact, he can't recognize his mother or his brother, and he'll look at himself in the mirror and say, it's obviously me, it winks when I wink, and when I move my head, it moves, it's a mirror reflection, I know that intellectually, but it doesn't look like me, and I don't know it's me. I can't recognize it as being me. And this suggests that that region of the brain, the fusiform gyrus, is somehow specialized for recognizing faces. Now, it's not as though he cannot see the face, not as though he is blind, but he can read a newspaper, he can tell you what color jacket the person is wearing. If he's a good artist, he can even sketch the face, or he can take a pencil and draw the face outline, so he can clearly see all the outline, the nose, the shape of the nose, the eyes, and everything. But he can't tell you who it is. Or even better, you can show him the face and give him a multiple choice of 10 faces and say, which one does this face resemble? And he'll pick the correct answer. So he can, in some sense, recognize all the features and see the similarity with the prototype. What eludes him, however, is the identity of the face. Who is this person? Is it mom? Is it dad? Is it Joe? Is it Charlie, the veterinarian? Is it my doctor? Who is it? That's missing, right? So this disorder has been known for a long time and led to the idea that the fusiform gyrus is somehow involved in recognition of faces. But a much more rare disorder, in fact so rare that very few neurologists have heard of it, is called the Capgras delusion. And how many of you have heard of the Capgras delusion? Okay, those of you who watch me on TED. Okay, but for the benefit of others, I'll just repeat it. The Capgras delusion refers to a person who, unlike the prosopagnosic patient, for example, I saw a patient not long ago, well actually a very long time ago, who was in a car accident and then was unconscious, was in a coma for about 2 weeks, came out of the coma, seemed completely normal, he was lucky, a little bit slurring of speech, he had dysarthria, but other than that, he was intelligent, articulate for the most part, could talk to you, engage in intelligent conversation, could play chess with you, all of that seemed fine. Emotionally stable, not obviously psychotic and mentally disturbed in any way, but he had one profound delusion. He would look at his mother and he would say, "Doctor, this woman looks just like my mother, but she's not, she's an imposter." Right? And he was absolutely convinced of this. And one of the important things I want to emphasize in everything I'm going to tell you is the selective nature of the delusion. The person's not crazy. He's not deluded about anything else. right? It's only affecting his mother, sometimes his father, sometimes his spouse. So usually the mother, he'll say, this woman is an imposter. Now, why would this happen? The odd thing is, the standard explanation for this in the old days, before we came along and some of our colleagues, was a Freudian view. And the Freudian view of this disorder is that this chap, same argument applies to women, but I'll just talk about guys, when he was a little baby and a little infant, he had a strong sexual attraction to his mother. This is the so-called Oedipus complex of Freud. And then as the child grows up, the cortex develops, the thinking part of the brain, and inhibits these latent Oedipal urges towards the mother. Thank God, otherwise we'd all be sexually turned on when you look at your mother. That doesn't happen because the cortex inhibits the limbic emotional structures in the brain. And then there's a blow to the head, damaging to the cortex, releasing this inhibition, and suddenly and inexplicably these sexual urges come flaming to the surface. And the patient's absolutely bewildered. If this is my mother, how come I'm being sexually turned on? This must be some other woman who's pretending to be my mother. Now this seems like a bizarre, far-fetched explanation, but it's the only one that makes sense to him, given that peculiar damage to his brain. So I was looking at this and it didn't make any sense to me. It's a very ingenious explanation, as indeed most Freudian explanations are. But it didn't make much sense to me because I've seen one patient with the same disorder, same delusion about his pet poodle. He'll say, doctor, this dog looks exactly like Fifi, but in fact it's some other dog pretending to be Fifi. Now you try the Freudian account here, it just doesn't work. He'll have to talk about the latent bestiality in all people or some such nonsense, right? Then we came up with an explanation in terms of the known neuroanatomy of the brain. I'm sorry, this laser pointer isn't working. But so in this chap, remember, he looks at his mother and says, it looks like my mother. So the fusiform gyrus, the face area, is normal, functioning normally. That's why he's able to look at her and say, it looks like my mother. But then the message, normally the messages are extracted in the visual areas in the brain. And then they all go into the 30 visual areas in the brain, believe it or not, 30 areas in the primary brain devoted to vision. It's all analyzed and processed and then sent to the fusiform gyrus where you recognize what you're looking at. This object is a chair or a pig or a table. It looks like my mother or whatever. And then the message goes to the amygdala, which is the gateway to the limbic system, the emotional core of the brain, the primitive emotional core of the brain. And the amygdala then gauges the emotional significance of what you're looking at. Is this a prey? Is it a predator? Is it a lion? Is it a tiger? Is it my departmental chairman? Is it or something utterly trivial like a piece of wood or a piece of paper or something I don't have to pay any attention to, right? Or is it a potential mate who I should pursue, or potential prey I should pursue, and so on and so forth. So that's what the amygdala is doing. And then the emotions then cascade into the rest of the limbic structures, down to a structure called the hypothalamus. And from there, the messages cascade down the autonomic nervous system, making your heart beat faster, blood pressure goes up, and preparing your body for ensuing action, for fighting, fleeing, sexual behavior, whatever is appropriate for that task demand. Now, in addition to blood pressure and heart rate going up, you start sweating as well to dissipate the heat you're going to generate from exercise. This is fortunate for us scientists because we can put two electrodes in the skin and measure the change in skin resistance produced by the sweating. Okay, hold that thought. So my idea was that maybe in this chap, the fusiform gyrus is normal. That's why he can see his mother and say, mother, it looks like his mother. But the wire that goes from there to the amygdala is cut off by the accident. That wire has been severed by the head injury. Therefore, he looks at his mother and says it looks like his mother, but there's no emotional warmth or terror, as the case may be, when he sees his mother. So he says, this is my mother. How come I'm not experiencing any warmth or any other emotion? This must be some other woman pretending to be an imposter. Now, how do you test this? What you do is you take any normal person here and put him in front of his computer screen and show him pictures of chairs and tables. Obviously, amygdala is not going to pick that up, and he's not going to sweat. But if you show him a picture of a tiger or a lion, he'll start sweating, and you can measure it. You get a huge, big jolt in the galvanic skin response. Now you could ask, why not just ask the guy? But that gets, unfortunately, it gets filtered by many layers of processing. So you don't. On the other hand, if you measure his galvanic skin response, you get a direct measure of his emotional reaction to what he's looking at. So if I take any one of you here, hook you up to the galvanic skin response, measure your change in skin resistance, and show you pictures on the screen of chairs and tables, nothing happens. If I show you lions and tigers, you start sweating. And believe it or not, if I show you pictures of your mother, you start sweating. You don't even have to be Jewish. Okay? So Now, on the other hand, when you put David here in front of the screen, he doesn't sweat to chairs and tables, obvious. He doesn't sweat to unfamiliar strangers. That's like any one of us here. But when you show him a picture of the mother, there's no change in skin resistance. It's absolutely flat, thereby supporting that idea. Here's the best part. His mother goes to the next adjacent room, and after about half an hour, she phones him. She says, "Hello, David." And he says, "Hello, Mom. How are you? Where are you talking from? It's great to hear from you." There's no delusion. Right? Then she walks into the room after an hour. He looks at her and says, "Who are you? You look just like my mother." It immediately becomes delusional. Now, it turns out there's a separate pathway going from the hearing center's auditory cortex to the amygdala. Right? So that pathway has not been interrupted by the head injury. So when he listens to her voice on the phone, the emotions kick in. He sees her in person, nothing happens. The delusion kicks in. Right? So here's a lovely example of cognitive neuroscience. The book is full of cases like this. Some of them I discussed in Phantoms in the Brain, but a majority of them are new cases which are unique to this book. And it's a lovely example because it is an example of a bizarre psychiatric, neuropsychiatric disorder. And you discard the Freudian explanation and come up with a simple explanation in terms of the neural circuitry in the brain, the evolution of emotional reaction to objects, and then say this pathway has been interrupted, and you spend 1 hour doing an experiment and show your theory is correct. Since then, they've been confirmed on lots of patients that this is on the right track. And in doing that, you not only explain the patient's symptoms, you also learn something about normal human vision. So this is a game we play again and again and again. You take these patients, which have been regarded as curiosities or anomalies, and brushed under the carpet. Well, what does that mean? You said 40. Okay. 40 means I have 40 more minutes, or I've done 40 minutes, or?
No, you've done 20 minutes.
Done 20 minutes, okay. Okay. So I'm going to talk for about 35 minutes, and then we're going to go into discussion. Okay. Okay, so the slide projector goes backwards for some reason. The next thing I'm going to tell you about is, I think I've already told you about, written about phantom limbs, and everybody, I'm sure most of you here know about my work in phantom limbs. Very briefly, I'll just tell you that patients with phantom limbs, 98% of amputees, people with amputation, have developed a phantom limb. And then the phantom limb is often frozen solid and in an awkward position. The patient will say the phantom is paralyzed, doctor, and it's fixed in an awkward position. And you'll mimic the position of the phantom in the normal limb and say it's cramped and it's very painful, it's excruciating. If only I could move the arm, it might relieve the pain. Now, I won't go into why the arm is cramped and painful and tight, but what I decided was to put a mirror in front of the patient. You should put a mirror in front of the patient. And the patient's left arm is a phantom on the left side of the mirror. His right arm is a normal arm, real or intact arm. And he looks at the reflection of the intact arm in the mirror. It looks like you've resurrected his phantom. And the patient's delighted about this because he knows you've not actually restored his arm. He's not stupid. But it's a compelling visual illusion that the arm has come back. And then if he moves his normal arm, he gets a visual illusion that the phantom is moving. But the extraordinary thing is not just a visual illusion. He gets the feeling that the phantom is moving, often for the first time in years, first time in 10 years, the first patient I saw. And then he says immediately to relieve the cramp, not only did it look like it was moving, it felt like it was moving. And then if he moved his hand like this and opened and closed his fingers, the phantom opened and closed his fingers as well. And this relieved the cramping sensation. So now the technique is widely used for treating phantom pain. Not only that, as I say in my book, it turns out even patients with stroke, a certain proportion of patients with stroke, the immobilization of the arm is not due to permanent damage to the fibers going from the motor pathway to the arm, which is the normal, usual reason why you get a stroke paralysis. Some of it is also this temporary interruption of signals. People hadn't realized that. So you put the mirror there and give them visual feedback. Astonishing thing, mirror visual feedback accelerates recovery of function from the paralyzed, from the arm that's been paralyzed as a result of stroke, which is traditionally considered incurable. And of course, very common. Phantom limbs are rare. Strokes, 1 out of 6 of you will develop a stroke. I mean, not anytime soon, but you will develop a stroke, 1 out of 6. So it's important clinically, from a clinical standpoint, it's extremely important that about 1/3 of these patients will benefit enormously. We've seen patients recover substantial movement in the paralyzed arm. Right? So this, and again, it's being widely used in clinics throughout the world. Now, That's about phantom limbs and stroke. Within phantom limbs, I thought I'd exhausted all possibilities, but I'll just mention two observations you said in the book. Sometimes the patient will say his phantom is swollen, and incredibly painful, and feels like it's swelling and about to burst, and it's painful. Now, I won't go into the details of why this happens, but in addition to being fixed in a position, it gets swollen and painful. And even if it's not swollen, the guy says, I can't see it, but it's painful. What you do is you put a mirror, and you put a magnifying lens in front of the mirror. It looks like the phantom has shrunk to about one-third its size. The astonishing thing is the pain shrinks as well, and sometimes the pain disappears. This has not been tested clinically on a large number of patients, but now you've shown it in one patient or two patients, people are going to start testing it clinically. Lastly, I'll mention an even more extraordinary observation. Here's a patient sitting here. I'm the guy with a phantom limb. My left arm has been amputated. Very simple. And phantom limbs, remember, have been known since antiquity, were described medically about 150 years ago by Silas Weir Mitchell. 100 years ago. So that's how long we've known about phantoms. So here's a guy with an arm gone. Here am I with my left arm gone, and I have a phantom limb. And I simply watch you being touched, your right arm being touched. Guess what happens? Or poked, or stroked, or hurt with a pin. I feel that in my phantom, simply watching you. Okay? Why does this happen? Again, you've got a medical mystery here. And this is seen in many patients, not just one patient, it's very common. If I poke you with a needle, the guy says, ouch, it hurts, my finger hurts. On the other hand, if I have phantom pain, if somebody massages you and I watch you being massaged, I feel the massage, the phantom massage in my phantom that relieves the pain. Now, how the hell is this possible? It sounds like science fiction, like Twilight Zone. Well, it turns out, a guy named Giacomo Rizzolatti discovered neurons in the brain. Remember I told you neurons in the front of the brain will start sending messages out through the internal capsule, through the brainstem, down the spinal cord, down to the arm. So when I do this, with the front of the brain, motor and premotor cortex is sending messages, motor commands to the arm. This is well known, been known for over 50 years. But what Rizzolatti showed about 10 years ago was some of these motor command neurons. Remember, these command neurons, if I reach and grab a peanut or grab a pen, the command neurons are firing, orchestrating a sequence of muscle twitches in order to go and skillfully reach for the peanut. If I take something and put it in my mouth, same thing happens. The different neuron fires. It's different motor command neurons because the muscle sequence is different. Right? Is that clear? So you get different motor command neurons for different semi-skilled actions. Now, a subset of these neurons, about one-fifth of them, believe it or not, will fire when I, or if I'm a monkey, if the monkey, fires, the neuron will fire even if I watch you perform that action, same action. So here's a peanut-grabbing neuron in my brain, in the frontal lobes. The same neuron fires when you reach out and reach out for a peanut. So this has been called a monkey see, monkey do neuron, or a mirror neuron. So what the neuron is doing, or the network it's part of is doing, is putting me in your shoes, allowing me to see the world from your point of view, doing a virtual reality simulation of your mind, seeing you, other people as intentional beings, and anticipating what you're about to do. So this is called a theory of mind neuron because it involves constructing a theory of the other person's mind or a virtual reality neuron or mirror neuron. Now, it turns out there are mirror neurons also in the back of the brain called sensory mirror neurons. Normally, in all of us, in the back of the brain, there are neurons which respond to touch or being poked with a needle. So if I touch you, a particular neuron fires. If I touch your elbow, it's a different neuron. If I touch your face, it's a different neuron. And there's a complete map of the body surface on the surface of the brain. Now, again, a subset of these sensory touch neurons, about 10% of them, will fire if I simply watch you being touched. So I call them empathy neurons, okay, or Gandhi neurons, right? And now you could say, why, if somebody touches me with a needle or pokes me with a needle, my neuron in the somatosensory cortex fires. But it also fires when I watch you being touched. Why the hell don't I get confused? So when I watch you being touched, I empathize. But I don't say, ouch, and pull my finger out. I don't literally feel the pain, nor do I feel a caress. If you're being caressed, I don't feel the caress on my hand. I don't get confused. My consciousness doesn't dissolve into yours. That's because my skin has receptors that are going back to the brain and vetoing part of the output of the mirror neuron system is saying, look, buddy, empathize by all means, but you're not being touched. Don't worry. Okay? But now if I remove the arm, there's no veto going on. There's no inhibitory signal. So I literally feel the sensation in my hand. So this is empathy carried to the extreme, or hyper-empathy. So now my mind actually dissolves into your mind. speaking metaphorically, actually not metaphorically, literally, because when I touch you, I feel the touch sensation in my hand. That's why I call them Gandhi neurons, right? Now, these neurons are of extraordinary importance. First of all, they have philosophical implications, because it shows you one of the mainstays of the ancient religious traditions, like Hinduism or Buddhism, and indeed many other traditions, is the notion there's no fundamental difference between you and other people. And of course, that sounds like bullshit, right? But in fact, what this is showing you, as far as your consciousness is concerned, another person's consciousness, the only thing separating you from that person is airwaves and some skin. You bloody remove the skin, you start feeling that person's consciousness, right? So it's like the global internet or Facebook and any of that. Our brains are all connected together by evolution. So if my mirror neuron fires, when your neuron fires, my mirror neuron fires in synchrony. It's a tiny delay. Right? Now, you could say, well, so what's the big deal about mirror neurons? Okay, well, first of all, you can massage the other guy and relieve pain. So clinically, it's important. It's also important from the point of view of human evolution, and I talk about this in the book, because if you think about it, if I want to imitate what you're doing, some complicated skill like threading a needle or cutting with a pair of scissors, I need to put myself in your shoes and go through the same sequence of muscle twitches as you're doing. This seems very effortless for you and me, but it requires elaborate computation by the brain to orchestrate your muscles to do the same thing, right? That's being done by mirror neurons. You say, well, what's the big deal about imitation? Who cares? It's mocking somebody. No, because imitation is the basis of acquiring skills in humans. Now, what took evolution? Suppose you want a polar bear wants to evolve a fur coat. It took several hundred thousand, maybe half a million years to evolve a fur coat through the random process of natural selection, right? Darwinian natural selection. A human child, a Homo erectus child or an early Homo sapien child, with his mirror neuron, rich in mirror neuron, a sophisticated mirror neuron system, watches its parent, its mother, kill and slay a bear, and in one trial, or in two or three trials, it learns exactly how to do it by imitation. So you've skipped 200,000 years of evolution in one generation. So evolution suddenly become from Darwinian, it's become Lamarckian. So once one creature stumbles on a discovery accidentally, like fire or something else, or hitting two stones to produce a fire, right? Some accidental discovery, it would have fizzled out without imitation, but with imitation, it spreads like wildfire horizontally through your peers and gets passed on generation to generation. So this is the dawning of what we call culture and civilization. So you're starting with this quirky little observation on monkeys, these neurons, and it has clinical implications and has vast implications for the dawn of culture and civilization in humans. And we have suggested that in fact, that's for 30 minutes, right? Okay. What we have noticed is, in fact, we've suggested that what you notice in autistic children is an inability to engage in pretend play, to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. So normally a child, during the development of a child, he or she will say, I can pretend I'm Superman with a little Superman doll, a Superman figure. And you temporarily put yourself, and you have two realities. One is the virtual reality of you being Superman, but at the same time you don't get confused, I'm still here, right? Now, that requires mirror neuron participation and its interaction with other brain structures. And empathy requires mirror neurons. Right? Imitation requires mirror neurons. And all of these abilities of the very theory of mind, seeing other people as intentional beings, requires mirror neurons. And these are the very abilities, it turns out, that are largely compromised in autism. And this we suggest that maybe the basis of mirror neuron dysfunction, maybe the basis, the main reason you get autism. Now, we're interested in the neural circuitry that causes dysfunction, causes autism, not what causes the neural circuitry dysfunction. Is it heavy metal poisoning, is it vaccine, is it viruses, what that is? That's an epidemiology problem we're not interested in. We're interested in it, but it's not what we do research on, right? But in terms of neural circuits, you have to understand what the neural circuits are before you can start thinking of ways of treating it. Okay, the next 5 minutes, what I want to tell you about is, here's all this complicated circuitry. I told you about hyper-empathy, phantom patient experiencing sensations in his hand when he's simply watching somebody else. And I talked about using the mirror to treat phantom pain. I'm going to tell you about one other thing for the next 5 minutes. It's called synesthesia. When I look at people here in the audience, all of you have normal vision. But it turns out that 1 out of 50 of you has what's called synesthesia. This is first described by Francis Galton, so it's not very rare. What it is 1 out of 50 of you, every time you see a number, you see a color. 5 is red, 6 is blue, 7 is green. The number is tinged with a certain color. 8 is chartreuse, 9 is indigo, so on and so forth. Or sometimes, in another type of synesthesia, every tone is colored. F sharp is blue, C sharp is green, and so on and so forth. So these people were considered crazy. Galton, who was the first cousin of Charles Darwin, noticed this in the 19th century, and he pointed out that it runs in families, so there may be a genetic basis, and we now know that's true, it has a genetic basis. He also, and since then, people have observed it's 7 times more common among artists, poets, and novelists than in the general population. Why would that be? So these are all the facts we had explained. Another example of a mystery where these people seem crazy. Why would somebody say 5 is red or 6 is blue? One explanation for the synesthesia in the last 100 years, there have been dozens and dozens of cases reported, so we know it's a real phenomenon. One explanation is that it's crazy. Now that's not a good explanation in science. And even if it's true, well, let's set it aside and see if we can explain it. Right? Very often, one of the things you learn as a physician is, if the patient sounds crazy, it usually means you're not smart enough to figure it out. Sometimes he is crazy, but that's a different matter. Right? So, what's going on here? Another explanation is they're just remembering childhood memories. Well, why would 5 be red? Well, you play with refrigerator magnets, 5 might have been red, 6 may have been red, 7 may be green, 8 may be blue. But we all play with magnets, and then not all of us are synesthetes. Secondly, why does it get passed down generation to generation? You never say the magnets are being passed down. This doesn't make any sense, right? So it's something to keep in mind. The third theory is maybe they're high on drugs, like LSD or pot, something like that. Maybe they're potheads. Now, this... maybe there's some truth to this because it's much more common in Berkeley than it is in UCSD. But let's set that aside for a minute. The fourth theory is these people are just being metaphorical and they say 5 is green. It's a bit like you'd say cheddar cheese is sharp. Well, cheese isn't sharp, it's soft. Why the hell do you say it's sharp? Well, you say, well, it's a metaphor. But why are you using a tactile metaphor to describe a taste sensation? There's a circularity in the reasoning there. And in fact, one reason I don't like this explanation is you can't explain one mystery with another mystery in science. Saying synesthesia, well, that's just a metaphor. Well, what the hell is a metaphor? How is a metaphor represented in the brain? We don't know. In fact, what we show in the book is synesthesia is a concrete sensory physiological phenomenon whose basis you can pin down in the brain, anatomically and physiologically. And that, in turn, can explain metaphor. Can give you an explanation, an experimental handle or lever for understanding more elusive aspects of the mind, like what is a metaphor. How do you do that? Well, first thing we did was, give me 5 minutes. See, I'm skipping all that. That's Darwin, that's, okay. Okay. One of the things we noticed was that the number and color area in the brain, which are also in the fusiform gyrus, by the way. So there's a face area here, but there's a number area and color area are also right next to each other in the fusiform gyrus. So we said, what's the likelihood that the number and color area are next to each other in the brain? Fairly small areas. And the most common type of synesthesia is number color, numbers evoking colors. This can't be a coincidence. What's going on is, for some peculiar reason, these people, the number and color area are cross-wired in these people. So every time they see a number, it evokes not only a sensation of a number, percept of a number, it spontaneously activates a color node or color neuron, and you see a particular color. So 5 is red, 6 is blue, 7 is green. Right? So how do you test this? Well, first of all, what we found was, if you show them, simple questions have not been asked. So here people were saying numbers are colored. Right? What if instead of showing them Arabic numbers, actually, I should call them Indian numbers, they come from India, but suppose you show them, instead of Arabic numbers, you show them Roman numbers, like a V, or V1, 6, or 7, what happens? Do they see colors? The answer is absolutely not. They'll say, I know it's a 5, I know it's a 6, but I don't see any color. So it's the visual appearance of the color is critical, not the numerical concept. And that's important. That gave us the clue, because this area of the brain, in fact, encodes only the visual appearance, not the numerical concept. It's higher up in the brain. So the number appearance evokes a color. Now, what we did was a number of experiments to show this. We did brain imaging experiments in synesthetes. You take synesthete and show them numbers, black and white numbers, 5, 6, 7. In a normal person, only this number area lights up. Color area does not light up. Whereas in a synesthete, the number area and color area light up, proving our hypothesis. Since then, a number of people, other people have done the experiment and shown this to be the case. Now, the next question is, why are they connected in some people? The answer is genetics. Remember I said it runs in families. It turns out all of us, when you're little infants, all parts of the brain were connected to everything else. There's a tremendous redundancy of connections, excess connections in the brain. And then you prune down the excess connections to create the modular architecture that characterizes the adult brain. And you have a number region, color region, and so on and so forth. Right? And face region and that. Now, if there's a mutation in the pruning gene, there's defective pruning here, and if the mutation is expressed selectively only in the fusiform, that can happen because of transcription factors. And then what you get is a number color synesthete. But there's excess connections or cross wiring between number and color, so every time he sees a number, he sees a color. That explains why it runs in families, because there's a mutated gene in these people. Now, what happens if the same mutated gene, the synesthesia gene, the cross wiring gene, is expressed throughout the brain diffusely instead of just in the fusiform gyrus? You get hyper-connectivity throughout the brain. What's going to happen? What do artists, poets, and novelists have in common? Remember I said synesthesia is 7 times more common in artists, poets, and novelists. What do artists, poets, and novelists have in common? They're all creative. They're all very good at metaphor, meaning they can all link seemingly unrelated concepts. And if you have, like, it is the yeast and Juliet is the sun. You don't say Juliet is the sun. Do you mean glowing ball of fire? No, schizophrenics do that. But all of us here, you immediately know that she's warm like the sun, she's glowing like the sun, she's radiant like the sun, she's nurturing like the sun. All the links are formed in your brain. There'd be two seemingly unrelated ideas, the sun, a celestial body, and Juliet, a young woman, right? Because Shakespeare was a master at this. So what I'm arguing is, if concepts are also represented in far, far-flung regions of the brain, and there's excess connections connecting everything to everything, then that's going to create a propensity to link seemingly unrelated ideas in some people. Hence, they're much better at metaphorical thinking and creativity. Hence, the 8 times, there's a hidden agenda of the gene. Why would this peculiar gene, making you see 5 as red, have persisted in the population so 1 out of 50 people see it? It seems like in evolution it would have been weeded out a long time ago through genetic drift. Didn't happen because it had a hidden agenda. It made some outliers in the population more metaphorical, more artistic, more creative. I'm going to conclude with this because people usually ask me when I say this, why doesn't everybody have this gene if it's that good, it makes you creative? Short answer is, evolution takes time. Maybe 100,000 years from now, all of us will have this gene, synesthetic gene. But the more important answer is, you don't want everybody to be metaphorical and creative. You want engineers, right? And also, suppose there's a surgeon doing neurosurgery in your brain, you don't want him getting metaphorical and creative on you. So you want the diversity and heterogeneity of the gene pool. You want creative types, artistic types, who are a little bit crazy, but you need them in society. You also need people who are more matter-of-fact in what they do. So the book is full of examples of this kind. I also was going to tell you about the origins of abstract thinking and all of that, which also humans excel at, and the emphasis on patients with lesions. And where I'm headed here is to argue that all of these problems, which seemed philosophical problems for over 2,000 years, what is empathy, what is love, what is the sensation, how do you see faces, what is art, it's one of the chapters in the book, which remain the province of philosophy until now. They've not made much progress with this, even though they've been at it for 2,000 years. We neuroscientists, at least for some of these problems, can begin to provide some answers by combining brain imaging with testing neurological patients and doing the right kinds of experiments on the right patients. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Fascinating talk. Fascinating.
Sorry, I went over my time.
Research. Yes, and we have lots of questions, so I would just go right into it. The first question is, in your book, you discuss the role of mirror neurons in human evolution. Mm-hmm. And you also talk about these phantom limbs and the fact that there is mapping of the neurons or sensations on the face, mm-hmm. where you touch parts of the face and the sensation is felt in the phantom arm. Can you tell us what is the evolutionary advantage of mapping these sensations or neuron connections on another part of the body? Is that redundancy, like jets have redundant engines? Or what is the evolutionary advantage for that?
That's a very good question. Well, there are two questions embedded in one there. The question of mirror neurons, I've already answered the evolutionary question, why they're important. Very important to understand that they're not functioning on their own. They're connected with a number of other structures. Even lower primates, probably lemur has mirror neurons. It doesn't have an advanced civilization. So mirror neurons may be an essential part of the story, but that by themselves they can't do anything. I mean, they have to be connected to other regions of the brain. The human mirror neuron system is especially sophisticated and may be connected in more sophisticated ways to other parts of the brain to enable sophisticated imitation and emulation, hence learning skills and evolution of culture and all of that. Now going back to the remapping, which I didn't talk about, when you amputate the arm, I mean, I didn't talk about it in my lecture, but it's there in my book. It turns out there's a complete map of the body surface on the surface of the brain, those of you who don't know about this. And if you amputate the arm, what happens if you touch the face? The person feels the sensations in his missing arm. Now, why would that be? It's because what happens is when you amputate the arm, in this brain map, the arm region is not getting any signals. It's devoid of signals, right? It's not getting any signals. It's hungry for new sensory input. So the skin of the face, sensory input from the face skin, which normally goes only to the face area of the brain, invades the vacated region of the brain corresponding to the missing phantom arm. So when you touch the face, it goes and activates not just the face area, now it cross-activates the hand area of the brain, and whatever is interpreting those signals higher up interprets them as coming from the missing phantom hand. Now, does this have an evolutionary function? Not directly. It has absolutely no use in saying, when I touch my face, I feel it in my phantom. But it's a manifestation of a more general principle of plasticity of organization, which may indeed have an evolutionary function. For example, Mike Merzenich here in San Francisco has shown that if you use your fingers a great deal, the finger representation of the arm becomes larger because of the increase in sensory input. This may increase the efficiency of coding, increase the acuity of your hand because a larger chunk of brain is devoted to it now. Nobody's actually proved this clinically or in proper experiments, but it stands to reason that might be true.
Another question is, when you deal with your subjects with the same symptoms or afflictions, do you notice any difference in males and females? In other words, are these neurotic connections or disconnections, dislocations, manifests in the same way as males and females?
In general, no. For example, phantom limbs, you see exactly the same thing, same remapping, same mirror neuron referral, you know, hyperempathy, whether it's male or female. Capgras syndrome, you can get it in men, you can get it in women. Most 90% of these syndromes, you see the same thing in men and women, right? But there are specific syndromes affecting sexuality, like transsexuality. I wouldn't even want to call it a syndrome because people who are, who experience transsexual symptoms don't want to call it a syndrome, and so it's inappropriate to call it a syndrome. But you can explain it in terms of some reorganization of the brain, and that of course, is going to depend on what sex you are. So unless you're studying syndromes which are specifically related to sex, most of the other syndromes, there's no difference between men and women.
Okay.
There may be small differences, but that's not what we're studying.
Okay. The saying that goes like this, old habits die hard, right? We all have heard about it, and we have experienced it. In terms of implications for the phantoms and the use of the mirror box that you use in your research, is there a trick, quote unquote, that you can tell us about something to do to get rid of our bad habits, say smoking or overeating? Is there something you can do like a mirror box to train ourselves?
You show them video feedback not smoking or something. It's a good question. First of all, with the visual mirror feedback, your point about old habits die hard, it's perfectly valid because what happens is if the patient's had a phantom limb for a long time, it's harder to get rid of the mirror. He has to practice longer. Similarly, stroke, long-standing stroke, is very difficult to treat with the mirror feedback. Whereas if you treat him right away, a few weeks, months after the stroke, there can be, in some patients, substantial recovery of function. But that's not your question. Your question is, what about other disorders? Well, we've thought of using it for things like anorexia, where you have a distorted view of your own body, and indeed even panic attacks. Panic attacks often arise from misattribution. So you've got an autonomic storm for some reason. You get a release of neurotransmitters in the limbic structures of the brain, and you get emotionally aroused for no apparent reason. And you get your heart pounding faster, blood pressure goes up, heart rate goes up, and you start sweating. You've got all these signs of emotional distress and anxiety. Normally there's a lion or a tiger or a mate or a boss or something out there to explain this. But if it happened inexplicably in your brain because of an autonomic storm, the brain gets confused and you say, there's an impending doom, you're going to die, and you get a strange feeling of terror because there's nothing to attribute it to. So then we came up with the idea of false attribution. You can use your cell phone to produce a picture of a lion or something. I don't know exactly how you do it, but something very, very realistic that maybe abort the panic attack. If you present it sufficiently early during the aura phase, we'll abort it.
Mm-hmm.
So people have suggested these things, but nothing obvious comes to mind how you would do other disorders. What would be the analogous treatment using mirror feedback? What would be analogous to that for smoking or addiction, things like that?
Another question is, Why are some people more visual and some others are more audio? Is that a genetic base or is it the childhood experience?
Well, I'm not an expert on that, but what I would say is that, you know, in broad terms, and you don't need a brain expert to say this, that the general variation in brain capacity and brain function based on genes, but also based on the environment, it's always a complex interaction between the two. In terms of emphasis, most, you know, 99.9% of people emphasize vision. Vision is the dominant sense in humans and all primates, right? But I think what they're really talking about is music. Some people are musically inclined, or some people may have perfect pitch, and others don't. But even they, vision is not compromised as a result. Visual perception is always good, right? Visual aesthetics may not be very good. That's a different matter altogether. We do talk about that in the book. But as far as basic visual function, there's not much variation across people, unless you're blind or you've got some dysfunction.
An audience asks, do you agree with the premise of Rebecca Costa's book, The Watchman's Rattle, that the human brain is approaching the cognitive threshold, and is there such a thing?
It's hard. It's kind of like a prophecy. One is making, knowing so little about the brain, you can't extrapolate in that manner that you've already saturated. You know, the other day somebody asked me, is it true, doctor, that you only use 10% of your brain? That's a very common question. Hmm. And I say, only in Texas. it's a kind of question which is like a factoid, you can't really answer. So the same thing about brain has reached a saturation point. I don't think that's true. I think if you discover how the brain works, you may be able to emphasize or enhance some of the functions much more than you're capable of now. Alan Schneider in Australia, and I talk about this in my book, finds if you zap the left frontal parietal region or right frontal parietal region, depending on what you're tapping into, patient suddenly produces artistic drawings when you're zapping the brain temporarily. So for 10 minutes, you get an artistic person. Mm. When the stimulation wears off, he loses the ability. So can you do this repeatedly, make him more artistic, or make him more better with numbers? So these things are being tried in Australia by Alan Schneider. Mm. So I don't think there is a saturation point. Obviously, you can't become Superman, but you can enhance certain functions. The trouble is you know so little about the brain exactly, you don't want to mess around with it unless you really understand what's going on.
Being of Indian origin, hopefully you may have some insight beyond your scientific training
on this. Consciousness and God?
Yeah. It says, what is responsible for spiritual and mystical experiences?
How did I guess? Well, I think there are two questions there. As a neurologist or somebody doing research as a scientist, the answer is there are specific regions in the brain and the temporal lobes whose activity, we know that people have temporal lobe seizures, many of them, about 20 to 40%, have intense religious mystical experiences. This led to the idea nearly 100 years ago that maybe there's something going on in the temporal lobes that makes these patients more prone to having religious experience. So what I would argue is there's circuitry in the temporal lobes of the brain whose activity predisposes you to religious and mystical experiences. It doesn't happen in other parts of the brain. If you have the occipital lobe seizure originating in the occipital lobe, you don't have religious experience, nor in the frontal lobe, or not in the parietal lobe, but in the temporal lobes you do. So there's some degree of specialization. Now, why it evolved, how it evolved, why does it produce these experiences, one can spend an hour discussing this. But then there's a more abstract metaphysical question. What is religious? Is there truly a God, a truly religious experience? That I'm not competent to answer any more than anybody else here.
Let me follow up this question because it's a fascinating question. Yeah. Is this sort of description that you give, making some people more predisposed to these experiences, is that a quantitative thing? In other words, I could feel a little spiritual, but some Buddha would experience that to the extreme. Is that a quantitative?
Yeah, it probably is. I mean, people haven't studied that in any detail, but if you want to start saying that great religious prophets of temporal lobe epileptic seizures, better be careful, you know. But I think the whole spectrum of mystical religious belief may indeed depend on degree of activity of these circuits in the brain. Now, I want to emphasize this doesn't in any way invalidate the experience. Nor does it mean if the Buddha had a great epiphany or St. Paul or anybody had a great epiphany, it doesn't mean that that's negated by the fact that it's happening in the brain. I mean, just because an orgasm happens in your brain doesn't mean there's no orgasm, right? So the fact that you have a religious experience doesn't diminish the intensity of the experience, nor does it have any bearing on the existence of God. The fact that, obviously, if you want to experience God, it's going on in your brain. It's not going on in your little finger. It's going on in your brain. So that's maybe God put an antenna there for you to be able to experience. I'm not being frivolous here. I'm saying that there's no bearing on the true question of whether God exists or not. Right? But on the other hand, I think we're learning something by saying that these regions of the brain, the activity of these regions predisposes you to mystical experience.
Another question. What biological changes or causes lead to multi-personalities in a single person? I think another way of asking this question is, are there any attempts in the field of neurosciences combined with psychology to try to connect the behavior with the specific genes and gene products?
Well, there are different questions there, but you know, the answer to the latter question about genes and gene products, of course, yeah, there's a great deal of evidence that behavioral patterns are influenced profoundly by genes. And there are specific disorders like dementias, like Huntington's chorea, you get profound dementia as a result of single gene mutations. And people are trying to do those things. It's not my area of research.
So is the field of psychology becoming more quantitative and, as you call it in your book,
more
reductionist? Are we moving in that direction as a scientific community?
We are indeed moving in that direction. But again, what people have not successfully done so far, there are some examples like memory in the hippocampus or somatosensory representation, phantom limbs, and things like that. But for most functions, most of the higher functions of the brain, like morality or judgment or love or whatever, what you need to do is, this is a great revolution in molecular biology, right? You have heredity, which is a macro phenomenon. A pig gives birth to a pig, it doesn't give birth to a donkey, right? You say, well, that's kind of obvious. But why does it happen? How come the pig only gives birth to a pig? There's a complementarity of offspring and parent. And Crick and Watson saw that the logic of the complementarity of the gene, the two sides of the helix, it's a striking analogy between that complementarity and complementarity of offspring and parent. So there's a functional complementarity. The functional logic of the anatomy of the DNA molecule dictates the functional logic of heredity. That kind of beautiful mapping of function onto structure has yet to occur in neurology. People have done it to some extent with memory, with LTP, for example, with Eric Kandel and others. But for many areas in neuroscience, we're still just scratching the surface. We haven't done that. The hope is in another 50 years or 100 years, we'll get there.
There's a question that I don't have a clue what it is, but I'm going to read it. Do you believe, I think, in existence of indigo children, crystal children, etc.? If yes, what is the difference in their writing pattern or wiring pattern?
So the indigo children and crystal children?
Yeah, I don't know.
I believe in it.
What is it?
I don't know.
I don't either.
Well, I'm being frivolous, but I don't know. I don't understand the question.
Yeah, I didn't know, but I was curious what that was. Okay. You suggested in your book that laughter is species specific.
Yes.
Why do you think humans laugh, but other animals do not? What connections or part of the brain is missing in those animals that do not laugh?
Well, I don't think its specific structure is missing, but certain connections might be more pronounced in humans that allow us to laugh or make us laugh. And I say in my book, I did a whole section or a whole half a chapter dealing with laughter and humor. It's interesting you should raise that because there was this student who I went and I was doing a neuro exam on her, or patient, I should say. Then I was poking her with a needle, different parts of the body, and she's saying, ouch, ouch. I mean, sorry, I take that back. A normal person would say, ouch, 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 you know, when you poke them with a needle. This woman started giggling every time I poke her with a needle. She found it hysterical, kept laughing. Poking with a needle, and she's laughing. This is the ultimate paradox, human being laughing in the face of pain. So this got me thinking about, forget about her, why does anybody laugh? Right? Then we can try and explain why she laughs, right? When you poke her with a needle. Well, it turns out that if you ask yourself, what do all jokes and humor have in common? What they have in common is, you take a person along a garden path of expectation, like when you're telling a joke, you build up a storyline, and then at the very end, there's an inflection, a twist, which entails a complete reinterpretation of the same facts, complete change in the storyline. And then you burst out laughing. That's called a punchline, right? So this happens also. Now, of course, that's not enough to guarantee humor and laughter. I mean, if a famous scientist is coming up with a theory, and you say it's all wrong and reinterpret the fact, he's not going to find it very funny. I do this all the time, and they don't laugh typically. Right? So what's the key difference? So let's look at slapstick. It's all there in the book, but I'm going to say it here. Well, let's consider a slapstick. A portly gentleman is walking down on the path. There's a banana peel, and he slips on the banana peel and falls down. It's the basis of slapstick comedy. He doesn't hurt himself, and he looks at him and wipes his face. You start laughing. It's especially funny if he's big and portly. I don't know why. Don't ask me. Okay? But then, if he slips and falls, and he cracks his skull and blood starts spilling out, you don't laugh, typically. You go and call the ambulance, or you go and attend to him, rush to his aid, or you call the ambulance. But in the other case, when he slips on the banana peel and wipes it off, you start laughing. Well, what's the key difference? Key difference is, in the first case, there's blood spilling out. There's been a real danger or anomaly, so you go and call the ambulance. In the second case, there's a potential danger. He's slipping and falling, but it's a false alarm. He's wiping out the banana and looking around and make sure he's embarrassed about the whole thing. So what you're doing is when any creature produces a stereotype sound like laughter, ha, 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 okay? When you do that, you sort of immediately think the organism trying to signal something to other organisms, to other peers who share its genes, right? So what is the signal here? The signal is it's nature's okay signal. It's saying, look, guys, the guy's not hurt, don't worry, be happy, right? So that's its okay signal, is laughter and humor. Now you say, how do you know this? You're just making it all up. Well, of course, it's speculative. But first of all, you know that laughter and humor is hardwired because every culture, every civilization, every society has laughter and humor, except Germans, but but everybody else does, and this strongly suggests that it's hardwired. It doesn't prove it, but strongly suggests that it's hardwired. Mm. Now, and I've tried to explain the evolutionary logic of why it evolved as nature's okay signal. It also explains tickling. Right? This is a little child, and this big menacing adult comes towards it, and comes like this, looming towards it. And then it's like, kuchy, kuchy, kuchy. I don't mean any harm. Right? So it's got the same logical structure as adult humor and laughter, so it may be a playful rehearsal for adult humor and laughter. It's all unique to humans, but you see rudiments of it in chimps too. If you tickle them, they'll produce some cry that's analogous to laughter, but not the kind of cognitive laughter that humans have, right? So now what's got to do with the patient I was talking about? In that patient, we found out there's damage to a connection between the insula, one part of the brain, and on the two sides of the brain, buried in the sides of the brain, and a structure called the anterior cingulate. Now, in a normal person, when you poke him with a needle, the insula feels the sensation of pain. What we think of as pain as one thing actually involves several layers of processing. There's initially the sensory aspect of it. This is pain, it's not touch, it's not velvet, it's not heat, it's not cold, it's pain. That happens in the insula. Then the message goes to the anterior cingulate, not directly, but after going through other pathways, goes to the anterior cingulate. The anterior cingulate says, ow, the agony of the pain, the emotional response to the pain is in the anterior cingulate. What's happened in this patient is, The anterior cingulate is normal, insula is normal. It's a bit like the Capgras syndrome. But the wire that goes from the anterior cingulate, from the insula to the anterior cingulate, is interrupted by the stroke. Mm. Therefore, what happens is, the patient, one part of the brain is saying, my God, there's a potential danger, it's going to be painful, it's going to hurt you. But then the anterior cingulate, the very next second, is saying, oh, don't worry, there's nothing coming in. There's no danger signal. So you've got the two key ingredients, potential danger, followed by a deflation, saying, don't worry, there's nothing happening. So the patient starts giggling uncontrollably. And she says, it feels incredibly funny, I don't know why.
Okay, unfortunately, we've got to a point where we have time for only one question. Okay. And I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative to Please. Ask that question myself. Please. It's not scientific, but despite the fact that I have a lot of scientific questions. Recently, or at least in more recent years, Hollywood seems to have a fascination with mind. The most recent movie is Inception. I don't know if you've seen the movie Inception.
I didn't see it. I heard good things about it. Yeah.
Yeah. And your own work has been featured on PBS. Will there be a movie based on your findings and your research? You're in Southern California.
If they can find somebody to play me, yeah.
How about Brad Pitt?
No, not Brad Pitt. Maybe Leonardo.
Leonardo. Okay. Well, with that note, I want to thank you very, very much for a delightful conversation and insightful discussion. Thank you very much for being such a good audience. I'm sorry I couldn't go through all of your questions. And join me, please, to thank Dr. Ramachandran. I just, again, want to remind all of you, for those who are listening on the radio, this has been a program of the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. And at this time, I would like to declare that this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley is adjourned.
Thank you.